As I said earlier, it is good to join together with you on this Sunday and to come to a place that has become kind of familiar to me over the past several years. Good to be back. As some of you may know, your minister Amy and I knew each other from the early days of my ministry with the Nashua Unitarian Universalist Church, and she was serving a church up in Vermont at that time, and we became friends, and we've continued our friendship over the years, and I appreciate her inviting me to come back here once again. In a speech that he gave during the last presidential campaign, former President Bill Clinton used the phrase, "We who have more yesterdays than tomorrows." And those words were all I remember from that speech itself. It kind of stopped me right there because I knew I was among the we to whom he was referring. Realizing that I'm kind of at that point in my life and have been for a bit of a time now, what prompted me to write the book that Brian introduced you to a little while ago, I decided it was time for me to do some summing up, which is not an unusual phenomenon for persons my age bracket. I'm assuming I still have a few more trips around the block yet, but figure this was a good time to try to pull some things together. And when it comes to my spiritual journey, the summation I offer goes from the Sin and Salvation revival meetings in the Evangelical Baptist Church of my youth in southern West Virginia, all the way to the Unitarian Universalist ministry, which is far more of a story than I can tell right now. There were any number of stops and starts and twists and turns along the way, and that's what I try to trace in the book here, drawing on some of the sermons I've written and delivered over the years as a way of recounting some of my travels of the Spirit. But in doing this, my wish was much more than to simply offer a personal journey. What I hope I can share are some of the guideposts I found along the way when it comes to finding meaning, purpose, and spiritual depth in living, particularly when some of the more traditional religious answers to such mysteries of existence no longer work, which is what I found to be the case for me once I got to about college. So I found it's my further hope then that some of the guideposts that I have found will be useful to those who read the book. And so the title to start with that is, I will admit, straight, as I do in the text as well, it is a straight steal from my longtime friend and colleague in the Unitarian Universalist ministry, the late Reverend Forrest Church. Forrest passed away 10 years ago in 2009 at the far too early age of 61 of esophageal cancer. Among the many books on liberal religion that he wrote and published in his lifetime, and he was a real great advocate, great spokesperson beyond our UU movement for liberal religion in the late 20th century. One of the lines in his book that has kind of stayed with me is the one that said, "God is not God's name, it is a name for that which is greater than all and present in all." Well, and I found those words very helpful, for I feel they take this whole belief in God conversation to a much more productive and meaningful place than one of going in circles of whether or not someone believes in an entity called God. They get us out of a semantic box as to what the term God might or might not mean. And instead, they call us into a spiritual journey of exploration for that which is greater than all and present in all. And if one chooses to call that object of that quest God, okay, that's all well and good and fine by me. But I feel the journey is far more important than the terminology. And that's what the book is finally all about. How do we stay on a meaningful journey of discovery for that which is greater than all and present in all? And how does that journey help us to better understand who we are and why we're here on this earth for the time that we're given to live our lives? I pursue this question from a number of angles in various chapters, and the one I'm going to focus on here is titled Belief Versus the Religious Impulse. And in it, I note that the thing that's kept me in the ministry through all of my meanderings has been a matter of, quite literally, going beyond belief. For I found that when I could discard certain beliefs that no longer sustained me, I couldn't quite shake off religion or the religious impulse. And in defining religion as I'm using it here, I go to yet another of Reverend Church's well-known lines. Religion, he maintained, is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and knowing that we will die. Or to put it another way, religion is our human attempt, our human impulse, to ultimately make some sense out of the lives we're living, even as we know we will never completely figure it all out. And so for all these beliefs that I discarded along the way and put in others and moved them around and all of that, I continue to believe in this religious impulse. And one of the more poignant expressions of this impulse is in the reading I offered just a few minutes ago by the late Ralph Helgerson. It's titled Impassioned Clay. It's in our hymnal. You may have used it as a reading in some of your services. I'm going to recall just a few lines here. Deep in ourselves resides the religious impulse. Out of the passions of our clay it rises. And then he concludes, we have religion when we have done all we can. And then in confidence, trust ourselves to life that is larger than ourselves. And that last line captures best from me what the religious impulse is. It's about looking up from our individual states of existence to a life that is, as Helgerson puts it, larger than ourselves, and in which we feel some trust and confidence. Or to put it another way, the religious impulse is the drive to feel at home in a universe that still remains greatly mysterious to us, which fills us with awe and wonder and occasionally fear. All right, it's a caveat time here. I am well aware of the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad, thank you, Judith V. Orst, ways in which religion gets used, or make that abused. My knowledge of world history is enough for me to know the wars that have been fought, the tortures that have been inflicted, and the executions that have taken place in the supposed name of religion. In a somewhat less brutal but still unconscionable manner, I am aware of how religion can be used to, it can be manipulated to foster useless guilt, to rationalize all matter of repression and wrongdoing, and provide a means for self-aggrandizement on the part of any number of holy hucksters who are able to convince enough willing followers that they possess the whole truth. Well, I'm not an anthropologist, but I would say that religion arose at the same point in human evolution where proto-humans became Homo sapiens. And that was when, as I'm thinking about this, that our earliest human ancestors found enough of a respite from their immediate survival needs when they weren't being chased by lions, tigers, and bears, or whatever else they had to do just to keep themselves alive. They could look up, look around, look at themselves, and ask, why? This was also the stage in which our earliest ancestor brains had developed to the point where they could ask, even in the most seminal of ways, questions about their existence. Mysteries in their lives and their world were somehow just beyond their grasp. Now, there's a mythological recounting of this stage in human evolution in one of the creation myths right there in the opening chapter of Genesis. You've got these proto-human beings, these mythological creatures, given the names of Adam and Eve, and they have this defining moment. The eyes of both of them were opened, and they discovered they were naked. Now, this passage is not about a couple of mythological creatures seeing each other's bodies as well as their own for the first time and trying to get themselves under wraps. That's the way the story's told. But I see it also as a fanciful recounting of that prolonged period over human evolution when our first human ancestors, or our earliest human ancestors, attained self-awareness. Their eyes were opened, and they beheld themselves. And this emerging self-awareness in time came to include an awareness of their mortality. And that, I would offer, was the beginning of religion. It's when we began to ask why. So the debate over whether religion is a force for good or a force for evil, yeah, that can be of some value when it comes to gaining a better understanding of how those conflicting forces operate. But it's a debate that's never fully resolved. And the contention by some well-intentioned purposes that the world would be a much better place without religion, we can cue up John Lennon here and imagine, and no religion too, I don't think in the end that holds up. Because religion exists, as I hope I've just shown, because human beings exist. And we have within ourselves this religious impulse that Helgerson describes. And while that impulse can be put to all kinds of destructive ends, it is ultimately life-enhancing, provided it is responded to in life-enhancing ways. And yes, there are certain beliefs or life stances that can help us meaningfully respond to this religious impulse, and I address some of them. But part of what I call the belief trap is the notion that a given set of precisely delineated beliefs can fully and adequately address this religious impulse, which is patently absurd. It is this notion, in fact, that lies at the heart of many of the abusive ways in which religion gets used. But rather than go on with all the negative effects of trying to reduce the religious impulse to an exclusive set of beliefs, I try some humor. For while cruising the internet for some sermon material some years ago, I came across a comedic category for the best God joke ever. I didn't know there was such a category, but apparently there is. Well, the joke is actually a stand-up comedy routine done by a Chicago-based comedian named Emo Phillips. Several versions and variations on this floating around. I'm sure I can't do it as well as he does, but I'll give it my shot. This is Emo Phillips. Once I saw a guy on a bridge about to jump. I said, "Don't do it." He said, "I have nothing to live for because nobody loves me." I said, "God loves you. Do you believe in God?" He said, "Yes, I do." I said, "Me too. Are you a Christian, a Jew, or a Muslim?" He said, "I'm a Christian." I said, "Me too. What denomination?" He said, "Baptist." I said, "Me too. Northern Baptist or Southern Baptist?" He said, "Northern Baptist." I said, "Me too. Northern Conservative Baptist or Northern Liberal Baptist?" He said, "Northern Conservative Baptist." I said, "Me too. Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region or Northern Conservative Baptist Eastern region?" He said, "Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region." I said, "Me too." "Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Regional Council of 1879 or Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Regional Council of 1912? He said, "Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Regional Council of 1912. And at that, I said, "Die, you heretic scum," and I pushed him over. I get a good laugh every time I read that. I'm aware that suicide is a very serious issue, but a thing that I still always get a kick out of that. Like most good comedy or satire, this one has a bite to it, having to do with the absurd lengths to which matters of religious belief can be taken. The not-so-humorous part is that over the course of human history, particularly in the West, persons have been persecuted, tortured, and even put to death over lesser or finer points of theology and belief than what's contained in this comedic routine. And the means of execution quite often was far worse than getting tossed off a bridge. And so for all the laughs I get from Mr. Phillips' comedy bit, when I place it in this kind of broad historical context, it does become a little less funny. And it also points out how an insistence upon the rightness of one particular set of beliefs takes us away from the true essence of religion. And what is this true essence? I've already offered how Reverend Church and Halverson answered the question. I'm going to take another swing at it using a Latin exercise that I had to do clear back in a high school Latin class when I was a member of a class in 1963. You can do the math on that. Anyone ever took a beginning Latin class, you may know how it goes. You take a multi-syllable English word, and you break it out into its component parts. You find out what the Latin derivation of each part is, and then you put it back together, and you see what you've got. Well, here's what you get when you do that little exercise with the word religion. You get re, R-E, which means again, as in repeat or return. The ligion part comes from the Latin verb ligare, which means to bind together. Same term from which we get our word ligament. Ligament is what holds your post to. My wife had to have a wrist fusion done several years ago because the ligaments that were holding the bones in her wrist, for some reason, are just deteriorating. The bones are floating around and they're giving her all kinds of pain. So she had to have a wrist fusion. A ligament is what keeps your bones in place. Well then, we put these two Latin fragments together when it comes to the word religion, and we get to bind together again. Religion then, in the most basic sense of the word, is the search for that which ultimately binds our lives together, gives them some sense of wholeness, and sustains us again and again over the ups and downs of our lives. And so religion in this sense, I feel, is much more of a verb than it is a noun. It's an ongoing process in which we engage in seeking greater levels of meaning and wholeness. It's a process that can involve times of great uplift, can also flow through some of our deepest and darkest nights of the soul. And yes, our beliefs do play a role in this process. The crucial question is, what kind of belief, what kind of role? They can be stepping stones or ports of call in a greater and ongoing spiritual journey, or they can short circuit the journey if one feels that any single port of call, any one creed, contains the whole truth or represents the final destination. And for all the beliefs that have come and gone, the ones I've discarded and the ones I've held on to, I find the words of the singer and writer Iris DeMent to be very helpful, and they keep me honest. You heard it earlier, Florence and Libby, wonderful job, both of you. Thank you so much for that. Iris DeMent, "Let the Mystery Be." Everybody's wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody's worrying where they're going to go when the whole thing's done. But no one knows for certain, and it's all the same to me. I think I'll just let the mystery be. I believe in love, and I live my life accordingly, but I choose to let the mystery be. Well, I pick up on this theme in the epilogue of the book, which is what I'm going to begin to wind down with here. This is the epilogue after I'd written all this other stuff. In my first semester of college freshman English class, one of the novels we were assigned was Albert Camus' The Stranger. I found it to be the weirdest book I'd ever read in all of my 18 years. You know, when you're 18, you think you know about everything there is to know about everything, and then you spend the rest of your life finding out all you don't know. Anyway, it was something about The Stranger, was something about this French guy named Mirceau living in Algeria, whose mother dies, and he's not all that affected by her passing. Then he more or less stumbles into committing a murder for which he ends up being sentenced to death. At his trial, the prosecutor makes more of Mirceau's seeming indifference to his mother's dying than to his practically inadvertent killing, but Mirceau gets the guillotine anyway. By the time I finally got to the last page, I was in such a hurry to just be done with the book that I read right past its key passage. In that passage, Mirceau is in his jail cell a few hours away from his execution. He's just had an angry argument with the prison chaplain, who unsuccessfully tried to get him to turn to God while he still had the time. Mirceau notes, "It was as if that great rush of anger at the chaplain had washed me clean, emptied me of hope, and gazing up at the sky, spangled with its signs and stars, for the first time, the first, I laid my heart open to the benign indifference of the universe." As I said, I had no idea what I was reading when I first read those words. I mean, I could follow the storyline, bizarre as it was, but I couldn't see the point the author was making. My mind and my thinking at that time was still very in the early stages of my religious journey at that point. My mind and my thinking at that time were simply not equipped to even catch a glimmer of understanding about what was being said in this short novel. A few more years had to go by, Before I was ready for any kind of engagement with this atheistic, existentialist, French philosopher, novelist, and playwright, Mr. Albert Camus. As I moved across the various landscapes of my spirit, the words of Camus' Meursault hover over me and haunt me. I too often gaze at the sky, spangled with its signs and stars. And while I'm not in a jail cell awaiting the guillotine, I view these signs and stars with an awareness, sometimes conscious, sometimes not, of my mortality. What Camus is saying, as I eventually figured out, is that for all of our searches for meaning, for all the many life-fulfilling and life-sustaining meanings with a small m that we may derive over the course of our lives, we ultimately live in a universe that is as absurd as the situation in which Meursault found himself. It is also a universe that reminds us with what Camus, through the words of his main character in The Stranger, calls benign indifference. On first take, the phrase benign indifference sounds like an oxymoron. Most dictionary definitions of benign use words like gracious or kind or favorable. How can the universe regard us in a gracious or kind or favorable ways and still be called indifference? Indifferent. But there's another definition of benign that gets closer to what Camus was saying. Not malignant. We live in a universe, according to Camus, that wishes us no harm. Not malignant, one that's simply indifferent to our existence. Maybe so. I don't discount the possibility. Maybe I live and move and have my being as a creature in the universe that's completely indifferent to my existence. But even if that might be the case, I do not choose to live in a stance of indifference myself. Even if the universe is ultimately indifferent to my existence, I do not have to live as one of its creatures by being indifferent towards it. I find too much joy and pleasure and fulfillment, along with my times of pain and despair and emptiness as I live my life, in one minuscule piece of this vast universe I inhabit. I can't be indifferent. And my counterpoint to Camus comes to yet another of my Unitarian Universalist ministerial colleagues, the late Reverend Dean Starr. Several years prior to his passing, Dean lost a son, Paul, to the AIDS virus in the early 1990s. At a gathering of his fellow clergy members a few years later after Paul had died, Dean recounted a story of how he came to find some reconciliation with the loss of his son. He told about how he took a boat cruise off the west coast of Naples, Florida, Gulf of Mexico, as he continued to grieve deeply about the loss a year later after his son's death. Here's how Reverend Starr described the experience. The entire sky, from horizon to horizon, was aglow with colors. Reds, purples, pinks, and golds. And then the colors faded, and the indescribable deep, deep indigo of late twilight filled the sky. Then the boat turned around, and on the eastern horizon was a full and glorious moon. With tears streaming down my face, I realized that although my son's being had been scattered, he remained a part of this awesome beauty. We can never contain the beauty in which we live and move and have our being. Whether we live or whether we die, we're contained within this beauty. Dean was saying that there's an uncontained beauty, a greater web of life, a larger chain of being. Some choose to call it the presence of God that holds us in our time-bound lives during our time on earth and holds the continuing presence of our lives beyond our physical existence. Catching a glimpse of this greater beauty did not remove the reality of the death of Reverend Starr's son. He had to live with that for the rest of his life. But the experience he described reminded him, as it can remind us, that life with a capital L is greater than any one of us, greater than our individual lives. And so for me, this is what it all finally comes down to. Is it Camus' indifferent universe, or are we contained within a body, whether we live or whether we die? I think on these things. For all my thinking, for all my pondering, I wind up back with Iris Dement. I think I'll just let the mystery be. Be glad to talk with you soon.